week's edition of World Crisis Radio. National crisis about that in the stock markets. Wall Street Journal headline, World Markets Shudder. That's today, the 5th of February, as we're recording the show. We also have the hack intelligence director, the intelligence czar, created post 9/11, that is to say, Dennis Blair, who says that an attack, a false flag, although he doesn't say so, a false flag terrorist attack on the United States, another one of some size, is inevitable in 3 to 6 months. It's coming. And after that, of course, you've got to look at everything, be it the Super Bowl, be it the upcoming Winter Olympics in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. That would be close enough, and some other events, and figure what's going on there. And we'll have some stuff later on about the new strategic deception doctrine that has been launched from the Pentagon by Yoda Andrew Marshall, who's trying to do American maskirovka, the strategic deception policy. And that can include just about anything, as they say pretty bluntly in a report that has just been issued by the Defense Science Board, but really by the Yoda Network. So we've got all of this going on, and the world situation deteriorating rapidly. 2010 will be a year of convulsions, conflicts, and the second wave of the Depression now hitting. And, of course, the second wave of the Depression will sweep aside those who say that bailouts work. They'll be discredited, but it will also, and perhaps even more savagely, sweep aside those who say it's time to balance the budget, impose free markets, strip people of their rights under Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth. In other words, our dear friends from Austria by way of Chicago, we need the American system of political economy. That's the doctrine professed by the founders, the George Washington administration, dominated by the personality of Alexander Hamilton. If those aren't the founders, I don't know who is. Not somebody like George Mason or somebody like this. Those are the founders. But now let's look at the big unfolding international story, which is the confrontation between the United States and China, the superpower rivalry, which has now emerged. We have to basically go back in time. Think about the Spanish world supremacy. The Spanish world supremacy was reached sometime under King Philip II of Spain, maybe between the 1560s and about 1590 or 1600. They had something like world supremacy given their world empire. This was then beaten down by the defeat of the Spanish Armada, the revolt of the United Netherlands, and then ultimately by the successes of Henry IV of France in reuniting France and creating France as a counterpoise to the Spanish power. So that by about 1600, you could say that the Spanish supremacy in that absolute sense was clearly on its way out, although it took many more decades and indeed the 30 Years' War to seal the end of the Spanish supremacy, which then became hollowed out and collapsed. The French supremacy starts with the Battle of Rocroi, R-O-C-R-O-I. This is the end of the Spanish-French prolongation of the 30 Years' War after 1648, so that we can say the French supremacy lasts from about 1660 to about 1700, 1705, when it's busted up by William of Orange and the Anglo-Dutch, and that's your War of the Spanish Succession at that time, much criticized by Jonathan Swift and other people who were reasonable at the time. So you can see that these world supremacies, if we look at the Spanish example and the French example, they last for several decades. And I think what we're seeing now is the end of the sort of unipolar U.S. supremacy, which is not healthy, which has not been good for us here in the United States, very bad for us, very dangerous for the world, and, of course, marred by terrible crimes. It had a benign form, if you would, under Clinton, relatively benign, and then an extremely malignant form under Bush the Younger. And now under Obama, it's becoming totally crazy, because this is even crazier than Bush when you look at it in terms of what it's actually doing. So let's go right to the heart of the matter. Is the speech made by Madame Clinton in Paris at the end of last week at the École Militaire of Paris, the military academy. And here she warns China about Iran. Let me also make the point before we go any further. For about 2 years, I have argued that an attack on Iran, be it by Israel, the United States, or some combination of this, was extremely unlikely because it basically would have meant giving up the entire strategy that the Brzezinski, Nye, Samuel Huntington faction had advanced as a replacement for the bankrupt approach of the neocons, the Cheney, Bush, Wolfowitz, Pearl, and company, which was not working, which had failed. So the idea was try something now different, but it different meant you couldn't attack Iran in that way. The idea now of attacking Iran, I think, has at least come back on the table, and within the framework of what I said about the false flag warnings, it becomes more plausible. And the reason for this is not because of Iran. With Cheney and these people, it was the genuine desire to destroy Iran as an end in itself. In this case, it is not so much that as the desire to use Iran as a club, as a gambit against China. China is now the target of everything. There's a hysteria in the U.S. British ruling elite, which penetrates everywhere, which is the, I guess we can call it the Götterdämmerung complex, right? The twilight of the Anglo-American gods. They think that their era on the world stage is ending, and in a way it is, although not in a way that any of us need to be concerned about. What they're concerned about is the ability to continue to conduct themselves with this overweening arrogance. Back in the 1960s, we had the arrogance of power with LBJ. Now we have the arrogance of impotence because it's all done on the basis of an economy which has collapsed compared to what LBJ had. So the idea of an attack on Iran now becomes plausible in the following context. Mrs. Clinton at the École Militaire had just met with the Chinese foreign minister. That's Mr. Yang, Foreign Minister Yang of China. And she had said to him, Yang, you have got to vote for sanctions against Iran in the UN Security Council. And the answer was, no, Boucher, not doing it yet. But now we have to learn the Chinese for this. He's not going to do it. So she then paraded herself to the École Militaire. Now, it's reported by our Parisian fashion correspondents that Mrs. Clinton was wearing a new Parisian perfume, probably from the house of Sarkozy and Kouchner, which is called Chantage. Chantage meaning blackmail, because that was the essence of her little talk. The blackmail to China was this. It says, we demand, the U.S., the Anglo-Americans, the international community, as they like to put it, we demand that you vote for crippling sanctions against Iran. The Chinese, of course, have this veto in the Security Council. This is a big problem for the Anglo-Ams. So we demand that you vote against your best friend or a good friend or a possible good friend, Iran. What does this mean for China? Well, if China alienates Iran, they lose 10-12% of their oil right away, because that's the oil that would normally go from Iran to China. There's also a matter of about $80 billion of development projects, which the Chinese have contracted to do in Iran. That would be lost. There's also several hundred billion of future oil purchases, and then there's the only hope of having a guaranteed overland pipeline from Iran to Pakistan to China to get the oil without going on the water where the British and the U.S. are going to rule the roost. Back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Tarpley.net. Tarpley.net is where you got to check in several times a week now. Things going up every couple of days. 2 to 3 commentaries this week. My appearances on Russia Today, but also articles, a detailed article on this Yoda business, right? The strategic deception coming out of the Office of Net Assessment in the Pentagon. And this guy is still there, 89 years old. He's been the founder of this Office of Net Assessment, been there since 1973, founded it, still runs it, and so forth. So take a look at Tarpley.net. The issue, though, treated in the in one of these commentaries, which is now going up at Tarpley.net, is the confrontation with China. So Mrs. Clinton says to the Chinese the following. This is a direct quote. She says, quote, China will be under a lot of pressure to recognize the destabilizing impact that a nuclear-armed Iran would have in the Gulf, from which they receive a significant percentage of their own supplies, i.e. of oil. We understand that right now it seems counterproductive to you to sanction a country from which you get so much of the natural resources that your growing economy needs, but you need to think about the longer-term implications. And then she goes on to say, if the Iranians get a nuclear bomb, this will convince Israel that it faces an existential threat. All of that is incredibly dangerous. Mrs. Clinton, in December 2007, the U.S. official national intelligence estimate concluded that there was no Iranian nuclear program to make bombs. Mrs. Clinton, what have you done with the NIE of December 2007, which was a key step in driving out the neocons, depriving them of the ability to start a war during 2008? Now this has been forgotten. But it's in a much broader context that it's been brought up again. The message of Mrs. Clinton wearing her new Dior perfume, Chantage, is to say to China, we demand that you cut your throat directly by alienating Iran. So you will lose 10 or 12% of your oil, 70 or 80 billion of development contracts, several hundred billion of future oil purchase contracts, your only hope for having this guaranteed, safe, secure overland pipeline, again, from the Iranian oil fields up through Pakistan, energy corridor, Pipelineistan, into China, through the Himalayas, above Kashmir, way beyond the reach of the U.S. fleet in the usual sense. So that's what they're demanding. Now, suppose if you don't do it, she's saying, if you do accept this as China, then it's clear what you're giving up. You're cutting your throat in all of these ways. You're giving up a great deal. But, she says, why would you do it? Because we're threatening you with something worse, and that is, if you don't support our economic sanctions against Iran, then we will no longer restrain the Israelis, right? We know the word to Israel all during 2009 coming from the U.S. has been no, 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 no. Don't you dare even consider this. But now that could be changing. Obviously, as long as you've got this green revolution, if you've got a CIA faction in Iran around Mousavi and these people who might take power, there's a great reluctance to do anything to put them in grave danger. Because if there is an attack, these people are going to be exterminated. That much is certain. But beyond that, the idea is to say to Iran, if you don't support our economic sanctions, crippling economic sanctions, then we will unleash the Israelis against you, or we'll, again, manufacture a Gulf of Tonkin incident or some other false flag incident, and we will then use that as the basis for having somebody attack Iran. If Iran is attacked, we're told that The Iranians have literally tens of thousands of missiles of all sizes, shapes, and vintages, all festooning their coast along the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf, depending on how you want to look at it, especially the area of Hormuz, especially the narrow sea there. There's some little islands, right, that apparently have got quite a few rockets on them, too. There are some patrol boats. There are some submarines. There's all kinds of stuff. And all of this could be thrown in so that the Strait of Hormuz would possibly be physically closed, maybe by sinking some big ship right in the middle of it because it's a narrow channel, and or simply by increasing the dangers to the point where the insurance premiums on the maritime insurance for tankers going through the Gulf would become so high that the economic viability of this traffic would be then called into question. So at that point, if Hormuz were closed, the Chinese would lose 30 to 35%, say about a third of their oil if Hormuz is closed by some kind of military action. Now, the Chinese seem to get about 20% of their oil from Saudi Arabia. There's some capability. There's a kind of a lateral pipeline that goes across the desert from the oil area to the Red Sea. There's a tanker terminal over on the Red Sea, but its capacity is much less than the facilities that the Saudis have in their tanker terminals there in the Gulf. And, of course, there'd be big international competition to see who would get that oil. The price, of course, would go sky high, $500 to $1,000 a barrel minimum. So the Chinese would be deprived of a quarter to a third of their oil in that eventuality. There's also the fact that the U.S. has shown such tender attention for Somalia and Yemen because these are the two points which guard the exit from the Red Sea, meaning all the traffic up there to Port Sudan. Port Sudan is another 6 to 7% of the Chinese oil. So Sudanese oil is big, Saudi Arabian, and all of this could be cut off because if the Saudis were involved in some kind of conflagration with Iran, then that might spill over then into the Red Sea on the other side, right, through terrorists or the Houthi rebels or whoever it is. So this essentially is the chantage. This is the blackmail of Mrs. Clinton to China. And there is a general sense in the Anglo-American ruling elite that they have the Chinese in an impossible bind. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. So it's a great gambit, they think. As long as we can make this Iranian crisis heat up, the Chinese are going to be hurt. If they turn against Iran, they're going to be hurt immediately. And if they don't, and then something happens in the Gulf, so to speak, then the Chinese may be hurt even more. Now, so of course, this is harebrained scheming, right? This is utopian lunacy. This is the product of these scenario writers, a lot of them grouped around the Office of Net Assessment in the Pentagon. There are various ways to get out of this. So let me just add, this has been the nature of the Iranian gambit ever since it started. You can go back to 1978, and you can read columns by Paul Marie Delagorce in the Figaro in Paris, where he says the U.S. Conflict with Iran is mainly a threat to Europe and Japan, not even so much to Iran. Back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
École militaire chantage gambit by Mrs. Clinton to China. You vote for these crippling sanctions against Iran and hurt yourself that way, cut your throat that way, or a war in the Gulf may result, which will hurt you even more. And the Chinese, the idea is it's a Hong Kong monkey trap, right, that the Chinese can't let go because they need this oil. So the U.S. thinks they have China backed into a corner on this issue, but, of course, reality always richer than the Anglo-American plan somehow, right? Ask Sir Neville Chamberlain and how surprised he was when things began to go wrong for him in 1940. So, Washington Post of this morning, China throws kink into U.S.-led push for sanctions on Iran. China has thrown a roadblock into the push for sanctions, saying it is important to continue negotiations as long as Iran appears willing to consider a deal and give up some of this enriched uranium. Quote, to talk about sanctions at the moment, right now, will complicate the situation and might stand in the way of finding a diplomatic solution, says Chinese Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi in Paris. Now, the Sarkozy regime of France is the point for this stuff. Obama is supposed to be a soft cop. Sarkozy and Fillon, his prime minister, and this Kouchner, this Trahison sans frontières, right? Betrayal without borders. This character with his notions of humanitarian intervention, this is a supranational, one-world imperialist meddler. In other words, it's imperialism, but dressed up in the language of human rights and humanitarianism. The French regime is pushing this stuff hard. Fillon says he will ask the United Nations to adopt a resolution proposing strong sanctions against Iran because of its nuclear program. But now, according to the Washington Post, it's going to take months of haggling to get the sanctions, the crippling sanctions that Obama wants. And they'll never be crippling because the Chinese maybe vote for symbolic sanctions, but maybe they won't. So you've also got this going on. So the immediate result of Mrs. Clinton's threats, the chantage speech at the École Militaire, is a failure. But now let's look at the at the background. I think we can identify about 10 areas of direct, severe, bilateral conflict between these two countries, plus feed in about two or three multilateral areas. First of all, the U.S. is systematically antagonizing China by meddling in Chinese internal affairs. It's a very sensitive topic, because it would be for you, too, if you had gone through the Celestial Kingdom of the Taiping, if you had gone through unequal treaties, treaty ports, extraterritoriality, foreigners taking the customs receipts, and all the rest of this. If your country had been a kind of playground or area for foreigners to run wild for the best part of a century and a half, you'd understand this. And above all, the three opium wars waged by the British in the 19th century to secure the import of opium from the British East India Company into China, all of this rankled. This has left a long tradition of bitterness. So the U.S. is antagonizing China. How? Taiwan, $6.5 billion worth of arms, including some pretty hefty stuff. It's expected here that the Chinese are going to sanction a series of aerospace companies who are selling to Taiwan. And the message is, you want to sell to Taiwan? Great. You're not selling to us. You choose between mainland and Taiwan. And you choose. Go ahead and choose, because you're not getting both. This would be Boeing, McDonnell Douglas. They make the Harpoon missile. United Technologies, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and so on down the list. So that is going to then translate, if it's basically Boeing, you're going to find the representatives and congresspersons from the state of Washington and a few other places are going to suddenly discover how foolish it is to antagonize China. So Taiwan. Tibet. Now, this we also have now the feudal monster, the Dalai Lama, whose regime was basically majority of serfs, minority of slaves, minority of parasitical Buddhist monks who lived off everybody else in every way. Hereditary debt punishment, quite commonly lopping off your arm if you did something this regime didn't like. This is this guy. So he's very spiritual. But he represents one of the most reactionary, backward, feudal landowning classes in the world. And he's now expected at the White House in mid-February. And, of course, Barbara Streisand and Richard Gere will be there swooning for this reactionary, feudal monster, the Dalai Lama. We'll do a number on the Dalai Lama probably next week, a detailed biography. He's been on the CIA payroll since about 1959-60, a minimum. There was a big bloody rebellion in Tibet fomented by the CIA. He got a book, The CIA's Secret War in Tibet. During the 1960s, he admitted he was getting more than $1 million a year from the CIA, and that has never ended. So he's got this operation set up in the north of India. MI6 loves him. CIA loves him. He's very spiritual, so the Hollywood degenerate elite goes for him. Anyway, this is now the U.S. meddling in Taiwan and Tibet. Let's not forget the Uyghurs of Xinjiang province, the northwest, Chinese Turkestan. Here we have Rabia Kadir and her group, the World Uyghur Conference, regularly attacked in the Chinese media as terrorists, and they have a case. Even the dark rumors about how these people make money, we'll have some more about that. They supplement their money they get from the U.S. government with various kinds of nefarious activities. There's also the question of the South China Sea. Here we are in the area of some islands which have got some oil and be claimed by different countries. Vietnam claims it. I think Taiwan claims it. Beijing claims it. The U.S. is in there massively. This is like, from their point of view, it's like going into Lake Superior and mucking around there, or better yet, Lake Michigan, something that's pretty much all in your own territory. So that's considered meddling. Cyberspace. We need to do a special thing on this. Google. According now to the Washington Post of yesterday, Thursday, February 4th, Google to enlist NSA to ward off attacks. So now we have an open public alliance between Google and the National Security Agency to fight the Beijing government. In other words, to try to force the opening of this cyberspace. The Chinese regard cyberspace as a part of sovereign territory, like airspace. Airspace, land, ocean areas, territorial waters, cyberspace. For them, it's all in the same area. And, of course, people are wondering, if Google is openly in a cartel with the NSA, does that mean if you're on Google that the NSA will be reading your emails if they aren't already? Well, probably. So I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe switch to Yahoo and see if that does any good. We're also told here in this interesting Washington Post coverage on the topic that this is nothing new, that it's been going on for a long, long time, that we're told that the U.S. Intelligence community works closely with firms like Google. And that it's traditional that this has been going on. Over the past decade, other Silicon Valley companies have quietly turned to the NSA for guidance in protecting their networks. The NSA is reaching out to other government agencies that play key roles in the U.S. effort to defend cyberspace and might be able to help in the Google investigation. Yeah. Investigation that starts with Google alleging that things were done to them by the Chinese government. Let's also never forget, on the morning of January 4th, the Chinese Great Cyber Wall came down through an attack apparently facilitated by Falun Gong and the NSA as a means of essentially destroying these cyber defenses against the flow of propaganda to this, you know, population of several million young dupes that might hang on to every word coming from Langley. So we'll be back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
To go to Reykjavik, Iceland. We're in the middle of the big fight between gallant little Iceland and the ogres and plug uglies and bullies of the International Monetary Fund, Great Britain, and the Netherlands, the Anglo-Dutch financier clique attacking Iceland, attempting to extort $6 to $7 billion. And there's a referendum scheduled, we still think, for March. But let's go to our correspondent in Reykjavik, and that's Thorarin Einarsson, who's, I understand he's babysitting this afternoon, so I hope our listeners will bear with any little voices there, right, coming from the background. But Thorarin, give us an update if you can.
Yes. Well, the good news is that in new polls, the no is up into 67%, two-thirds.
Tremendous.
Are going to say no.
And you are one of the leaders of the no bloc, right? The rejection front against all of this.
Excuse me, could you repeat?
Your website is the no bloc. Maybe you want to cite the website just for people from Iceland who may be listening.
Yeah. No, actually, it's not quite up yet. But, you know, it's almost finishing. But
okay.
I would like to remind about the other website, savethepeopleoficeland.com. It has been very nice to see all the comments, support from all around the world.
Great.
Some great comments there.
So what have we had? Have we had any significant meetings, articles, public statements, betrayals?
Yeah, well, okay, and maybe betrayals are on my mind now. It's very sad to see in Aftenposten, in a Norwegian newspaper, an article from a professor of economics, Icelandic, was really just warning us about the consequences of not paying. And it's very sad to see Icelanders abroad, you know, speaking against our interest. And also our prime minister, she has embarrassed us. She was just meeting now Barroso in Brussels.
Barroso, of course, being the dictator or the top honcho at the European Commission.
Yes.
For Portugal.
Yes, and the thing is that she did not didn't meet reporters after the meeting like other heads of state usually do, except maybe dictators from Asia, as one reporter said. So she she's very much criticized for not seeing the foreign press in generally, and it may be just because that she can hardly speak English, and she is she's been very much avoiding the press. I think she's just scared.
And this is Johanna?
Yes, Johanna Sigurdóttir.
Okay. Sigurdsdóttir, more or less.
Sigurdóttir.
Okay.
And
she's the Social Democratic Prime Minister, and the content of her Social Democratic Labour doctrine is pay the debt.
Yes, absolutely. And hurry up into the EU.
Pay the blackmail. Pay the extortionists.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a review. And another sad development that we get in the news now that Norway, the government, is considering the possibility to actually pay ISAF and give a loan to Iceland instead on a lower interest. And, of course, the Icelandic government is very happy about that possibility. It has not been, there is no, formal offers for negotiations, but this is actually seen as a possibility. I would be very sad. And still, also, we have the possibility that the referendum, of course, will be cancelled. There have been frequent meetings now, the heads of all political parties, and didn't give any result, no results except said just now, I think yesterday, seems like they're reaching an agreement, but I don't know what that is about, really.
All right, so as far as we know, though, the referendum is going to be, what, the 6th of March?
Yes, 6th of March, and so there is no campaign started, and the Minister of Finance has said that they are not eager to present their case until they have it more clear if they can reach a new deal in time.
Mm.
And so he is not so much worried about the polls that are showing 2/3 are going to say no.
The financier elite may try to call off the referendum completely if they're going to lose. I mean, remember in 2005, they lost on the EU expansion or the EU constitution. They lost in France. They lost in the Netherlands. Then later on, they lost in Ireland. Whenever there's a fair vote, they lose with these totalitarian initiatives that they have. So they might try, they could say, well, we won't make it a referendum, we'll do it as a treaty or something like this. That's what they did with the Lisbon business.
Yeah, the thing is that they could only cancel the referendum if they would reach a formal agreement with the UK and Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all agree that we have to have this referendum, and we just cannot cancel it. And now, without there is a real agreement inside, and that the UK and Netherlands would officially reject what is offered now.
I see. Now, let me just. My suggestion would be if you've got something of a vacuum in terms of things going on, I would try to fill that vacuum even with small forces, right? If you can make a bold show of, putting 10 or 20 people into the Parliament Square there and make a ruckus, and you probably attract some other people who are up for any demonstration at all, that, might end up, if not on the local news, it might end up on the BBC or some international media.
Yeah, I guess it would have to be a little bit, more and, even more unique. We have had, protest every Saturday, and it's getting thinner, actually.
Mm-hmm.
That's because of, the general situation of the financial systems and the loans. And it's like the people are getting tired of the whole thing, and also, of course, ISIF has always been discussed. Many people are getting tired of the whole thing. And so, of course,
right.
We need to use our creativity and imagination for a, for a breakthrough, effective breakthrough.
The other thing that occurs to me is you now have Greece, right? Greece, normally speaking, Greece would be on the verge of bankruptcy. But, of course, the tendency would be then for the European Central Bank, France, Germany, others to bail them out. But I think this what Greece is going through is now this extreme austerity, right, extreme budget cuts and, the brutal stuff. And that's going to lead then to a strike wave. And I think people could then look at Greece and say, this is what happens, chaos. If you go under mm-hmm. the IMF, you get chaos. Quick answer.
Yes, I was hoping to see like Latvia and Greece and Iceland making a coalition.
Right, an anti-IMF front, a little entente against the IMF. We'll see you next
yes.
week, Doran. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Hang
yes,
in there.
Too.
Keep fighting.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back in a minute. Of World Crisis Radio, Harpley.net. One of the scenarios produced during 2007 by the Defense, by the Office of Net Assessment through the Hudson Institute, is the Great Siberian War of 2030, which is, as the title suggests, something we've talked about here quite a few times, the idea of playing Russia against China. And it starts off saying Russia is hollowing out, China is filling up. China needs oil. Siberia has lots of oil, very few people. the Chinese are going to try to seize Siberia. The Chinese will try to seize all of Russia west of the east of the Urals. And that's going to lead to World War III, and it goes through. This is the work of the late Laurent Mouravieck of the Hudson Institute. He put this out in 2007. The contract came from the Office of Net Assessment, that is to say, Yoda being Andrew Marshall, 89 years old, been there since 1973. He may well be the longest-serving top bureaucrat in the entire U.S. bureaucracy. This is a gray eminence with a vengeance. And he goes back to the post-war Rand Corporation whiz kids, right? The strange loves, the guys going around with those binders, world targets and mega deaths, right? The strange loves from the original generation. He's still a younger, somewhat, well, younger than those who are no longer around. This is Andrew Marshall. And his group recommends, essentially, they say, in order to have successful deception, you've got to create a sophisticated series of orchestrated events and make your adversary believe in it. Now, think about the Gulf. Think about the Christmas Patsy bomber. Think about Major Hassan of Fort Hood. Think about Awlaki, the CIA lackey, and you'll get an idea of all of that. Let's just go back briefly to China. We've so far indicated the areas of conflict, U.S. meddling to antagonize China, and I think most of these are pretty straightforward. Meddling in Taiwan, meddling in Tibet, meddling among the Uyghurs of Xinjiang, meddling in the South China Sea. That's a little bit, well, there are claims, right? There are competing international claims. I suppose one ought to have an international conference, see who wants it and who doesn't. Cyberspace and Google. Let's just remember, and I thank Wayne Madsen for this. Wayne Madsen points out that the origins of Google are largely in the U.S. intelligence community. And one of these is an organization called InQtel. InQtel of Arlington, Virginia, but with other branches in California. This is a nonprofit venture capital firm, and I'm reading from Wikipedia, nonprofit venture capital firm that invests in high-tech companies for the sole purpose of keeping the CIA equipped with the latest in information technology to support the U.S. intelligence capability. It was originally named Peleus. It was also known as InQIT or InQIT and became InQtel, IN-Q, the letter Q, dash T-E-L, InQtel, launched in 1999. Hey, about the same time as Google. The mission is to essentially be at the forefront of all this stuff. So InQtel offers money, and they get a piece of the action. They get software infrastructure and related stuff. George Tenet writes about this in his biographic self-justification attempt, and that is to say, in the eye of the storm, I'm sorry, at the center of the storm, my years at the CIA, Harper, 1997, and that we learn about InQtel. In 2005, InQtel sold 5,600 shares of Google worth $2.2 million, and the way they got them was that Google acquired Operation Keyhole. Operation Keyhole being the CIA's satellite mapping software, which has now taken on the name of Google Earth. So there's a seamless cartel here, NSA, CIA, Google, I'm sure, Twitter, and others. This, I think, puts the question of cyberspace into a different context, because it's no longer a question of free speech or things like this. It is that, do you allow tentacles of foreign intelligence agencies to simply run wild, or do you have the ability to do something about that and to push back? The path of the Ukrainian elections, right, Yushchenko now being out, it's now come down to Yanukovych versus Tymoshenko, and that'll be decided this coming weekend. But the Orange Revolution in Kiev, November 2005, within about 5 years, that had completely dissolved into dust and ashes, similar to Obama in some ways. But you have this, essentially the idea is that a color revolution requires the presence of a large cushion of young dupes. And that's one of the keys to Obama. It's one of the keys to Yushchenko taking power with the Orange Revolution and the madman Saakashvili in Georgia, perhaps the worst of all of them. So do you let foreign intelligence agencies come in and mess with your inevitable population of idealistic young dupes and turn them into a battering ram for a seizure of power and the overthrow of the government based on essentially hysteria? In other words, not based on elections, but based on overthrowing elections, or at least the only elections you've had get overthrown. So that is, I think, the Chinese argument, and I think it's a good debate. Remember Jacques Sapir, S-A-P-I-R, I think one of his ideas was that the sloganeering about human rights and political rights has been used by the Western powers as a cloak for imperialist aggression and destabilization and the overthrow of governments they don't like for totally other reasons, generally because of economic resistance to the IMF. The slogans have been used so often that they're now totally discredited. And that is just the reality of the world, right? The attack on Iraq, 1 million to 2 million people killed in the name of democracy. Doesn't that sort of take the luster off these democracy and human rights slogans, even when they're delivered by the charming Obama? So the areas of sovereignty are Taiwan, Tibet, the Uyghurs of Xinjiang, the South China Sea, and cyberspace with Google now revealed as a tentacle of InQtel and therefore of NSA and CIA, and they're out there openly cavorting with the NSA. It's like a public alliance. It's like a convoy in World War II. In this case, the NSA provides the cyber warships and Google provides the payload, in this case, of inflammatory propaganda for these young dupes who believe that the West is cool and they want to go with it. So let's also add human rights, right? You've got a return now in the pages of the U.S. press to the Chinese human rights issues. This is fairly straightforward. In economics, you've got a conflict about the proper valuation of the Chinese yuan or renminbi, people's dollar. And that is simply that China wants to have the predictability of a fixed parity relationship with their main international trading partner, the U.S. Now, I would say you don't want to destroy the one fixed parity you seem to have. You want to make sure that everybody gets a fixed parity. That is the genius of Bretton Woods. That is why Bretton Woods allowed the fastest development rates we've ever had in world history before or since. But the U.S. says, no, we want to destroy the fixed parity of the renminbi with the U.S. dollar. There's also then the question of steel and oil protectionism. This is one area where I think the Chinese are simply wrong, but that's one of the things that they cite. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
In Washington, and this is the afternoon of Friday, the 5th of February. We got the Dow down 150 points. But the Dow is now 98.50. That means they've lost about 1,000 points since the speculative bubble top was put in sometime in late December, early January. So hold on to your hat. I have predicted this now, I think, in a number of places. The second wave of the Depression, it's based on the Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, Spain, bankruptcy situations. The British are certainly a part of that group, although they don't like to be mentioned in that context. And, of course, the commercial real estate crisis, the defaults on many, many leases now coming due. Those losses go to the banks. That has caused some jitters in the stock market, continuous high unemployment. I think it's now the unemployment supposedly went down to 9.7% this morning, but that is simply that people are giving up. They're just not registering because there's no more benefits. If you've exhausted your benefits, you're out of luck. And now the immediate stimulus package increases of a year ago to prolong the unemployment benefits, those are now running out. States are increasingly bankrupt. So we don't need monetarism. We don't need more deregulation, privatization, budget cutting, austerity, free markets, and all this claptrap. And we sure don't need cap-and-trade Malthusianism and all the rest of it. We have a viable economic tradition. It's called the American system of Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay, Matthew Carey, Henry Carey, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin D. Roosevelt, New Deal. Throw in the populists, too, because they're definitely in the tradition, the real populists of Omaha 1890, calling for a whole series of measures, including parity prices for agriculture. And if you like to eat, you better have those. So in terms back to China, though, the Chinese are antagonized, as we've said, over Taiwan, Tibet, the Uyghurs, South China Sea, cyberspace, Google, the human rights questions, the renminbi, and trade protectionism. Now, all of these are important issues. And again, I would say to the Chinese, drop the one about protectionism. Everybody in the world is going to need a modest protective tariff of 10 to 15%, and the U.S. will be lost without that. So I'm afraid at this point the U.S. actual national sovereign interests overrides the desire of the Chinese to dump cheap goods, if that's what they're doing, or anybody else's. We've got to have a return to some kind of a tariff protection for the protection of domestic wages and standards of living against sweatshop labor operating with cheap raw materials on cheap land and so forth. Otherwise, you simply can't compete. However, the perspective for the U.S. is to move ahead in key technologies. We'll get to that in a minute. The multilateral issues are, of course, the fact that the Chinese blocked the carbon dictatorship at the Copenhagen conference. This is now, I think, essentially proven to anybody who wants to see it. The Chinese did a very clever strategy. They used Sudan and a certain number of Latin American radicals and third world radicals in general. That was their screening force, and they blocked it. And they snubbed Obama in the process, and they basically said, why should we submit to having a worldwide carbon dictatorship, the main purpose of which would be to strangle China and strangle India along with anybody else who wants to develop under this carbon dictatorship. So there's a huge resentment from people like Prince Philip, Prince Charles, right, the lunatic Malthusians of the decadent European aristocracy, entitled nobility, and their friends like Al Gore, who's obviously a satellite of these circles. And then we get to the Iranian sanctions, and that's the one that could blow up in the face of the world, because, of course, you've got wild cards. You got Iran. What will they do? You don't really know. What will the Israelis do? You don't know. What will the Saudis do, right? Once the lid is blown off of this, then it becomes uncontrollable. The U.S. obviously thinks that if Hormuz is closed, the sufferers will be Japan, who get 90% of their oil through there, not even 30%, but 90%. China will suffer, others will suffer, and Europe. The U.S. probably less, and they would even say if oil goes to $1,000 a barrel, that's good for the dollar. That will create a massive demand for dollars, and you better do that if you're going to do it before the dollar the posted price for oil is no longer in dollars. Because once it's no longer in dollars, then you don't get any benefit. You only get the problems. And, of course, you'd be essentially extorting. You'd be getting the Chinese to use their $2.5 trillion of foreign exchange. You'd be saying to them, we're going to essentially rob you of that. We're going to force you to pay that at $1,000 a barrel for oil. And the key thing then is to break these contracts, which the Chinese have made with Iran, to lock in reasonable prices. Now, behind all this, an obsession in the Anglo-American elite. It's similar in some ways to the British looking at Germany before 1914. And here's the big issue. The U.S. can look at China and say, well, we're going to contain China. We're going to try to wreck them and sabotage them and break them up and embroil them in conflicts. We're going to use economic warfare, and we're going to foment conflicts. We're going to try to play India against China over these border disputes, which are heating up to some extent. We're going to use the Iranian gambit to hurt China. Maybe if we can get Russia voting for the sanctions and China voting against the sanctions, we can split Iran. Iran can be used to split China and Russia. This is the road to tragedy. This is what the British tried to do in the 1930s. This basically says Sir Neville Chamberlain is going to build up Hitler. I'm not comparing anybody directly, but just I'm talking about the sort of formal structural aspect of this thing. They said, we'll build up Hitler, play him against Stalin, get rid of both of them. And it didn't work, did it? It blew up in their face. So this kind of scheming and meddling is typical of imperialism, which is in desperate straits. The alternative, of course, is a peace race of peaceful economic development. This is what I recommend, because instead of having the conflict scenarios, the economic warfare and the conflict, which harm everybody ultimately and could blow up the world as we know it, go for a peace race of peaceful economic development. The U.S. obsessions are that China is now the largest exporter in the world. China has now passed Japan, or soon will, to become the largest economy in the world. I'm sorry, the second largest after the U.S. In real terms, it may be that China already is in terms of production, in terms of tons of steel, and so forth. And when you take the physical economic indicators, the Chinese may already be ahead. Because when you look at the U.S. GDP, you've got to remember a lot of that is derivatives. A lot of that is payday loans. A lot of that is stock jobbing and financial speculation, which has no relation to wealth. It's purely paper. It's parasitical. It's actually a net loss. So maybe the Chinese are closer to being the biggest economy in the world. If you don't like that, then go for economic development. Go for a peace rate, and you can you'll do just fine. Back in a minute.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Back to World Crisis Radio. So the London Wall Street elite freaking out. China is the largest exporter, second largest economy, maybe getting close to be the largest in real terms. The U.S. has 10% unemployment, really 20%. Chinese have 10% economic growth, and a lot of that is real. Not all, but a lot. Of course, they've got a long way to go for the 600 million peasants, essentially, the poor people in the interior, the parts of Western China. But let's look at a couple of key areas. You want to talk about national power. You're going to talk about nuclear reactors. You're going to talk about fast rail. And you're going to talk about your space program. Let's take these as three crucial indicators for who's viable and who's not. Nuclear reactors. The U.S. has about 100 to 103. They're antiquated. They're old. They're all pre-Carter. China is building 20 modern reactors. They're going to have a high-temperature reactor. I think they're going to have a fast breeder. They're going to have a whole array of things the U.S. can only dream of. China's building 20. India's building 6. The U.S. maybe 1, if you're lucky. The U.S. is lucky to be building 1. China, according to the plans, will pass the United States in nuclear power output. They will go beyond the 100 megawatts or so that the 100 plants, let's call it the 100 plant equivalent, gigawatts, the 100 gigawatts by about 2020 to 2025. So 10 to 15 years from now, China will pass the U.S. in nuclear power output, and their units will all be ultra-modern. They will have the most modern nuclear technology. And the U.S., if they're still going with these antiquated things we have now, the pre-Carter park of reactors, we will have the most antiquated system in the world. So you don't like that? Here's my recommendation. Before World War I, one of the things the British did, this was an arms race. I'm talking about a peace race. But in the arms race between Britain and Germany, the British felt so threatened by the German fleet. Every time the Germans would lay down the keel of a battleship, start building a battleship, Britain would start two. And the policy was called two keels to one. They lay down one keel, we lay down two. Well, China's building 20 reactors. Instead of building one, why don't you build 20 of your own? Why don't you build 40? Why don't you build 60? Why don't you build 100, which is what I recommend? 100 nuclear reactors immediately of the most modern type, fourth generation, pebble bed or gas-cooled, I guess, or all other types, but get the most modern technology and build an array of that so that you can match it. Again, if it's 20, match it, but better yet, go for 100 because that's what you're going to need, because otherwise this existing 100 that we have in the United States is going to be on its last legs. Second point, fast rail. Here it's even worse. China is already way ahead in fast rail. They have maglev. U.S. does not. They have the fastest bullet train in the world. Even Obama had to allude to this in his State of the Union message. This is 1,000 Ks from Canton, Guangzhou to the north, Wenhao, I think. And this one goes at 300 to 350 Ks per hour. And it's just, it's a fantastic modern thing. It's better than anything in Japan or Europe, to say nothing of the U.S. The U.S. has maybe 250 miles of fast rail. If you want to call the Acela at 110 miles an hour on you know, century-old rail beds using a modern Swedish technology, well, then the U.S. has 250 miles. The Chinese already have about 1,000 Ks, so call that 600 miles. So they're already ahead by 2-1. And here's the program. The Chinese program is $300 billion to build 16,000 miles of fast rail. And I think some maglev is included in there. The U.S. program with Obama is, if you're lucky, $12 or $13 billion to essentially ameliorate these 13 projects in 31 states that La Hood came forward with over the past couple of weeks since the State of the Union. Obama was in Tampa talking about this. But $12 billion for some minor improvements, essentially all of this is eaten up by the fact that the net level of investment is deteriorating. The U.S. rail system is deteriorating. It would take more than $12 billion just to stop the deterioration, to say nothing of moving back to actual improvement. China, $300 billion for 16,000 miles. Now, you don't like that? Well, my program is simple. 50,000 miles of maglev and fast rail, but mainly maglev, will essentially triple what the Chinese are doing. That would make sense for the U.S. That would be a real stimulus. So if you've got people who are beating their breast about the Chinese challenge, right, the Chinese peril, oh, my God, then go for a peace race. Let's have another one. Space. Here it looks very bad for the U.S. indeed, because here there's not even a pretense of doing anything. The Chinese put up their first astronaut cosmonaut in 2003. They orbited the moon with a satellite successfully in 2007. The Chinese have an ambitious, well-funded, and robust program of manned space exploration and colonization. They're going to the moon. Where is the U.S. going? Based on Obama's new budget, as announced by the despicable anti-science thug Peter Orszag of the Office of Management and Budget, this is the guy who hates mammograms, hates pap smears, not surprisingly, he hates the space program. They said that NASA will essentially liquidate, end, terminate its entire manned space flight program. There won't even be the Bush-era promise of going back to the moon by 2020. The U.S. is not going. China is going. I think India is going. But the U.S. is going nowhere. So tragic. This allows us to see perhaps the moment when the world will become aware of the scientific technological decadence and backwardness of the U.S. It's when the Chinese have astronauts on the moon, and the U.S. has nothing. The U.S. will be caught flat-footed, backward, whining, and so forth. And of course, this means several $100 billion of investments would be needed anyway. Now, where would you get such money? Well, the Federal Reserve has no problem at all coming up with 0% credit when they want to. For Goldman Sachs, for JP Morgan Chase, if you're a derivatives monger, If you're a stock jobber, if you're a financial speculative parasite of any type, you can be a bank, an investment bank, a hedge fund. You can be a brokerage. You can be a credit card company. You can be an insurance company. You can be a money market fund. For all of this, we have 0% credit. But then when it comes to real economic activity, from the very large to the very small, down to the local company, right, the dry cleaner, the restaurant, the auto repair shop, nothing. There's no credit for any of that. So if you want to keep pace with the Chinese and other challenges emerging in the world, you have got to open up that Main Street lending window, in other words, the industrial output window, force that open. This was done at the Federal Reserve, and you've got to force them to do it. You've got to force the Fed to issue 0% long-term credit for projects in the area, say, of a space program, a fast rail program, and the building of nuclear reactors. 0% long-term maturities, 40, 50 years, whatever it takes. Force them to do it. That amounts to nationalizing the Fed in part, and once you've nationalized that part, you want to suppress the other part and stop 0% lending to the J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley's of the world. And you do that, you can keep pace. You can take the Chinese programs and double them or triple them, which is what I've proposed. Back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
To World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Topley here in Washington, where we're awaiting the arrival of a blizzard here on Friday afternoon. It's supposed to be 2 feet of snow, yet another terrible stumbling block for the global warming fanatics. But now, as usual, we would like to keep up with the struggle for the U.S. Constitution and the resolution of this question about is Obama a natural-born citizen of the United States? Is he 35 years old? Is he eligible to be president at all, and why doesn't he come clean on this issue? Well, it's so easy, right? If you don't like all this ferment, then publish the original typewritten, ink-signed document from 1961, apparently, which was what he claims he's got. So for this, of course, we turn to Phil Berg. Now, Phil Berg, of course, distinguished lawyer and advocate from Philadelphia, Democratic Party official, Democratic Party candidate for governor, senator, and not going to Nashville, I think, despite all of the ferment about the Tea Party there, Phil?
No, I didn't go to Nashville, and, you know, the Tea Party's really split. I noticed that 600 people were there, and they paid like $600 a head. It's like a moneymaker. There's various other factions. We'll get to the next one. It's important. We'll see who it is. I'm more interested. The CPAC is a convention in Washington, D.C. in a week or two. I think I'm going to get down there.
Very interesting. Conservative political action conference. That's the biggest confab of essentially right-wingers that you have in Washington during the year.
Yeah, that's. I'm going to try to come down for that. And sorry I'm late on your show today, but Jeff Kuhner's show in Washington, D.C., I just spent an hour and a half on his show. Taking phone calls. I don't want to give him a plug, but it's good. We're getting out there I give Jeff credit for having me on, and I'll go on any radio station, or TV, any place in the country, and you're the best. You have me on weekly. But I think we're getting to, the president. Did you hear what happened the other day? I mean, I put out my release. We're calling for a birth certificate march on Washington. We're asking people, go to my website, obamacrimes.com, O-B-A-M-A. CRIMES.com, ObamaCrimes.com. We're calling for a birth certificate march on Washington. We're asking people to email, fax, or mail a copy of their birth certificate to us. We hope to compile a million of them and then present them to Obama or ask the people to join us in Washington. Can you imagine surrounding the White House, everyone have a copy of their birth certificate and say, Obama, why won't you show yours? But I think the next morning was the National Prayer service in Washington. And Obama, after at the end of his speech, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me here, but basically I think we're getting to, he said, like, no one should question my faith or, and he paused, or my citizenship. So I think we're getting to him. For him to mention that in the, at the National Prayer Breakfast, I think that we're making some inroads. And as he drops in the polls and as more and more people understand, we're just asking for some basic documentation to prove that he's constitutionally eligible to be president. So please, everyone out there, when the show is over, go to my website, ObamaCrimes.com. Send it to everyone on, in your address book. Ask them to send us at least a dollar, number one. Ask them further to please send a copy of their birth certificate, and mail a copy, fax a copy. Someone said, well, they can take information. If there's some information on there that you don't want to divulge, black it out. But at least produce a legitimate birth certificate, which Obama refuses to do. And if we can raise the public awareness and my March on Washington, the birth certificate march in Washington, I think this is the way to get to him. Remember now, Nixon went down not on the break-in at the Watergate. He went down on the cover-up of the break-in at the Watergate. We're now 13 months into Obama's presidency, and I hate even saying that word. And what do we have? We have a cover-up. We have a major cover-up that he's a phony, he's a fraud. But the fact that he mentioned the other day about this citizenship, I think we're making inroads. And you, everyone out there, we are all part of We the People. And that's how the Constitution starts. And We the People, we want a peaceful revolution, to stand up, stand firm, say we want the Constitution followed. And Obama, if you can't prove it, then it's time that you move on.
Very good, Phil. Let me point out, Jeff Cooner, this is WMAL here in Washington. This is the largest conservative news talk in the Washington, D.C. area. A lot of influential listeners to that. And this guy, Jeff Cooner, he claims to be an anti-globalist conservative. In other words, he doesn't agree with Limbaugh on free trade and a bunch of other stuff. So that's an interesting audience. It's 5:70 a.m. in Washington, D.C. Now,
he told me just for information that I lit up his board, and he's got me back on because the calls just came in. The board, they said, was never so lit up. And I do bring up a topic, and I answered every question. I'm not afraid of any question. I really think that Obama is a fraud, a phony. This is the biggest hoax against the United States of American citizens in over 230 years, and it's an absolute disgrace.
Very good. And remember, this guy competes with Limbaugh. So this is, he's got to offer something that Limbaugh doesn't have. And of course, Limbaugh has a lot of hot air, but not this content. The thing that gets me, Phil, is I see now, more attention to it. There's a poll that has been done by the Daily Kos, and they say, well, about one third of Republicans, I believe, think that Obama is not a citizen. And then they start wagging their heads and deploring this. The issue is so simple. Why not bring forward the original birth certificate looking like a document from 1961 with typewritten information, signatures in ink, and all the details that are not on this computer printout that Obama has posted? And that, I think, remains the overriding question. Why not bring forward your birth certificate if you claim you have one?
Well, it's obvious. First off, in one of his books, he says he has his birth certificate. So it's very obvious why he has not produced his birth certificate. He hasn't produced his birth certificate because it will show that he is not natural born. You know, he either has it that, I believe it's from Kenya. If it's someplace else, you know, it will not show that he's natural born. If he could show that he was natural born, we would have seen that birth certificate by now. You know, yes. He has now spent over $1.6 million fighting my three lawsuits and 50 other lawsuits out there. You don't spend that kind of money when you can get a duplicate birth certificate for the great sum of between $5 and $25. So that's what I think, and it's time that we have a peaceful revolution. It's time that all your listeners spread the word out there. It's time that people send in a birth certificate. It's time that people send at least a dollar to us to show we have support across this great nation. I'm doing this for all of you out there.
You want to give the mailing address for people who won't get to the Internet? Just give them a quick mailing address?
Sure, sure. My website is ObamaCrimes.com. They can mail it to Phil Berg or ObamaCrimes at 555 Andorra, A-N-D-O-R-R-A, Andorra Glen, G-L-E-N, Court, C-O-U-R-T, Suite 12, Lafayette Hill, L-A-F-A-Y-E-T-T-E, Hill, H-I-L-L-P-A, 19444. We could really use your support. They can even call me at 1-800. I don't have that number in front of me. Or another one, 610-662-3005. 610-662-3005. We want to hear from you out there. I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this for the 3.2 million men and women who have either died or been maimed in wars defending this Constitution. This is a disgrace that we're 13 months into the administration, and we know nothing about Obama. And I think we're getting to him by his remarks at the National Prayer Service just yesterday, where he came out, and it's in a paragraph. He didn't say, don't question my citizenship, but he said, don't question basically my faith or my citizenship. I think the fact he brought it up out there, that we're hitting a sore point there for him. He's a phony, he's a fraud, and let's get him out of there.
And I think everybody's got to be gravely concerned, because since this seems to be what you say it is, it means that he's blackmailable. It means that the invisible government clique, right, the Wall Street boys in the background, can get him to do whatever they want, because they can say, you do what we tell you, or we'll go with the birth certificate story, and therefore they can blackmail and extort the things that they want. So this is an issue for everybody. And we thank you, Phil, and we'll see you next week.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. So we'll be back then next week at the same time on World Crisis Radio. Remember, we're on demand anytime for free at gcnlive.com. And, of course, go to topley.net to keep up with all kinds of articles, my interviews from time to time on Russia Today, other materials going up. You can see things there in various languages. This is now in the top 100,000 websites in the United States. So we thank you for that. And we'll see you next week.